To find out how you can reach Latino USA's listeners, visit us online at latinousa.org/support.
From National Public Radio, it's Latino USA. We have two reports this week from our series on immigration. First, a priest travels with his Bible and camcorder to protect immigrants from racial profiling.
The reason why you have this camera on?
Yes.
Why is that?
I'm taking a video of what's going on here.
I think the church has to be relevant to people's lives. It's a bridge between the lives of the people and to be an instrument of God's reign.
And a study finds that the Constitution is on ice. We'll talk about U.S. agents entering homes without legal authority and arresting people based on racial appearance. Y la clave de las castañetas, the castanets, the key to jazzing up flamenco. That's coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us.
This is news from Latino USA. I'm Angela Maldonado. He was called the Liberal Lion and was a champion of progressive politics in the U.S. Senate for nearly half a century. Massachusetts Democrat Edward Kennedy died this week. He was diagnosed with a brain tumor more than a year ago. Last summer, he spoke at the Democratic National Convention.
So many of you have been with me in the happiest days and the hardest days. Together, we have known success and seen setbacks, victory and defeat. But we have never lost our belief that we are all called to a better country and a newer world.
In his 46 years in the Senate, Kennedy devoted his life to civil rights, labor rights, and health care. In the Latino community, Kennedy was an ally who worked toward immigration reform and was a co-sponsor of the yet-to-pass DREAM Act, which would make it easier for undocumented students to attend public universities. Campaigning for then-presidential candidate Barack Obama, Kennedy spoke at a rally in East Los Angeles.
Let me tell you, in my city of Boston, where my office is, I can look out that my window, and I can look to a pier in Boston Harbor. And that pier, 8 of my grandparents, great-grandparents, in 1848, came and arrived in Boston. And I can look along the sidewalk where they came. And then I can look along and see what they call the Golden Steps. There were steps that went on into East Boston. All of them walked up those steps and walked on into East Boston. They had nothing other than the shirt on their back, their willingness to work, their devotion to their family, devotion to their faith, and their desire to give something back to this country. That is at the heart and the core of the immigration issue, which Barack Obama understands.
In his career, Kennedy shaped immigration policy, starting with a 1965 bill eliminating national immigration quotas. He then went on to have a hand in measures that dealt with amnesty, refugee policies, bringing more high-skilled workers to the U.S., and most recently, a 2007 bill that would have set a path for citizenship for 12 million immigrants. Healthcare was also an important issue to Kennedy, and his death leaves one fewer vote in the Senate.
And this is the cause of my life, new hope, that we will break the old gridlock and guarantee that every American, north, south, east, west, young, old, will have decent, quality health care as a fundamental right and not a privilege.
Senator Robert Byrd from West Virginia has called for the current health care reform legislation to be named after Kennedy in remembrance of his life's work on the issue. A special election will be held to determine who takes over his Senate seat. In other news, more from Mexico. The country has enacted a law that will decriminalize the possession of small amounts of drugs, including marijuana and cocaine. People caught with small amounts of a drug will be encouraged to seek treatment. Previously, possession of any drugs meant a stiff jail sentence. In Arizona, $6 million is the amount spent by the U.S. to fly immigrants caught at the Arizona border back to Mexico. The six-year program has begun, and it's aimed to discourage immigrants from making a return trip and to cut down on the number of deaths from exposure in the desert. The immigrants voluntarily agree to be flown back to Mexico City. From there, they're given bus tickets to their hometowns. According to the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, the U.S. spent $13.5 billion last year to send almost 19,000 undocumented immigrants home. In Texas, a federal court ruling could signal the end of the unusual delegate selection process in the Democratic primary. Known as the Texas Two-Step, the Democratic Party holds both a caucus and a primary as part of its delegate selection process. In 2008, the League of United Latin American Citizens and other Latino organizations filed suit against the state Democratic Party, arguing that the system unfairly discriminated against Latino voters. As the system stands, delegates are chosen based on voter turnout from previous elections. The three-judge panel agreed with LULAC, stating that a potential for discrimination exists and could be subject to review by the Justice Department. The Texas Democratic Party is reviewing the opinion and has not announced how it will proceed. That's news from Latino USA. I'm Angela Maldonado. For more news alerts, visit us at latinousa.org.
It's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Churches across the country have declared themselves sanctuaries for immigrants. In New Haven, Connecticut, one priest has gone even a step further. He's teaching his parishioners how to stand up for their civil rights. Ushwini Umbarajan, a reporter with the Feet in Two Worlds project, has our profile of Father James Manship.
If you want a seat at St. Rose of Lima Church on a Sunday, you'd better get there early. Outside, cars are double parked. Inside, it's standing room only. People from 18 different Central and South American countries are here, and the priest preaches in a Spanish he learned for the job.
In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. La gracia, amor de Jesucristo, que nos llame a la conversión, este con todos.
Father James Manship, or Padre Jaime, never thought he'd become a priest. Growing up, faith was going to Mass and not much more.
We were basically your meat and potato Catholics.
Born and raised in Hartford, Connecticut, Father Manship graduated from college and began work as an engineer. But he felt a nagging call. He took a year off work, and that led to seminary. There, he was challenged by a teacher to be a priest for all people. And for Father Manship, that means working with immigrants.
I think the church has to be relevant. It has to be relevant to people's lives. It's a bridge between the lives of the people and to be an instrument of God's reign.
Father Manship sought to understand his parishioners. He traveled to their villages in Ecuador and Mexico to learn why they left. And he was creative in helping their undocumented children find a way to go to college. So Father Manship invited representatives from 43 different colleges to meet with teenagers at St. Rose, and more than a dozen got offers of admission. 19-year-old Mariangel says her priest made it all possible.
The only person who was there to help us was Father Manship. Even our guidance counselor I'm sure previous students at the school were undocumented, and there was nothing done to those students. All they could say, they feel sorry. You have the good grades, but there's nothing I could do.
You cannot solve a problem. But what we teach is how can we cut issues? So we got undocumented students. We got a paralysis in Washington about immigration reform. All right. So let's take a look at this just a couple of young people and see if we can get them into college. And so now we've got probably close to 15 young people studying in college.
For Father Manship, it's a simple equation. Faith equals power equals action. He says that he's inspired by the church's immigrant past in the United States. His role model is 19th century New York Bishop John Hughes, who stood arm in arm with his parishioners to fight the anti-Catholic mood of the times.
There's some anecdotal stories, and I don't know
the veracity of all of them, but in the Five Corners in New York, there was a group of know-nothings coming on down to burn a Catholic church down, which they were doing at the time, rounded the corner and found Bishop Hughes there with a mob of Irish Catholics went defending their church and sent them off running in the opposite direction and told the mayor and the police chief at the time that if a church, one more church burns in New York, you know, it's going to lift a hand on the Irish and it'll be turned into a second Moscow. Dramatic, but it gives you a sense of idea that, you know, this was a guy that was out there to defend his folks and his vulnerable, the vulnerable people at the time. And I think that's where the church is always the strongest, when we stand with the vulnerable, whether it's the unborn, whether it's the sick, whether it's the condemned, the immigrant.
Father Manship stands on that front line. Last year, he began documenting incidents of police harassment of Latinos in the neighboring town of East Haven. Then last winter, a Latino couple that owned a store there called in a panic. The police were threatening to arrest a fellow parishioner. Father Manship grabbed his video camera and drove to the store and started filming the police.
The reason why you have the camera on?
Yes.
Why's that?
I'm taking a video of what's going on here.
The officers took Father Manship's camera and arrested him instead. A few days later, with the media following his every move, Father Manship pled not guilty in court. He then walked outside and used the courthouse steps as his pulpit.
My arrest is a tip of a toxic iceberg of racial profiling in East Haven and the abuse of power by the police. It astonishes me that Latino parishioners can simply cross a town line and find themselves a target of terror, intimidation, and police brutality, all because of the color of their skin.
Father Manship's speech positions St. Rose as part of the long history of churches in the struggle for civil rights.
So the church becomes a real focus, a real place, a real safe place, a home, a public place where they felt safe.
Angel Fernandez is a member of the St. Rose Parish Council. After the arrest of Father Manship, he visited Latino store owners one by one to ask them to sign a letter in support of their priest.
I think it's all about trust. And it's not that we don't, in this country, we don't think our institutions are trustworthy. But certainly for newcomers, I think it's always very true that perhaps, you know, the place where they worship is going to be a place that they trust implicitly.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. Saturday.
At My Country Store, the site of Father Manship's arrest, we find owner Marcia Chacon in tears talking to reporters. Flyers from a white supremacist group were scattered across her front door this morning. A few days ago, a window was broken.
I don't want to choose words, I want actions.
Right.
Because I don't have customers. You can see I don't have customers.
Actions, not words. That's the core message Father Manship has tried to convey to his congregation about their faith. And he pounds away at it again during Mass on a Sunday following his arrest.
Now, la batalla es grande. La guerra es grande. Es enorme.
The battle is big, Father Manship says. He promises to fight and urges everyone to come forward to fight with him. At the end of the sermon, a group of lawyers are waiting, and people line up to tell their stories of harassment and racial profiling. Dozens of incidents are documented, from violent beatings by police to unjustified stops and arrests. Weeks later, the city of East Haven dropped all charges against Father Manship, but his fight continues. He's working with the U.S. Justice Department to file a civil rights suit against the town of East Haven. He's also joined with churches and synagogues across southern Connecticut to create a faith-based social justice movement. It's one more way to push the boundaries of his faith and try to move his congregation from the world as it is to how he believes it should be. For Latino USA, this is Ashwini Anbarajan in Connecticut.
That report was produced in cooperation with Feet in Two Worlds, a project of the Center for New York City Affairs at the New School in New York. A priest may have his pulpit, but lawyers know how to get crucial documents Peter Markowitz and the Immigration Justice Clinic at Cardozo Law School in New York filed two Freedom of Information lawsuits against the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, or ICE, and they found a disturbing pattern of illegal entrances into homes. Katie Davis has this report.
After lots of legal sparring, the documents were sent to Cardozo Law School. They came in dribs and drabs with sentences blacked out, says law professor Peter Markowitz.
It would be kind of a jigsaw puzzle for the law students and I to kind of piece it together to figure out what they actually meant.
Markowitz says they found an alarming pattern in two states, New York and New Jersey. Immigration enforcement teams showed up at homes without judicial warrants and then pushed their way in. Often, everyone was arrested. There was a cowboy mentality to these raids, says Markowitz, like this one on Long Island in 2007.
Around 5 o'clock in the morning, agents screeched to a halt in front of a private residence. They surrounded the house. They started banging on windows and doors, yelling police. When the occupants didn't immediately open the door, one of the agents climbed through an unlocked kitchen window. Another crawled through a bedroom window.
Markowitz says this is a clear constitutional violation. The Fourth Amendment guarantees the right of the people to be secure in their house from unreasonable searches and seizures.
Our Constitution provides certain protections to everyone here in the United States, regardless of alienage. And that's a decision that is kind of that our framers made and is one of the things that makes the individual rights in this country so robust and so unique.
The report found a pattern of misconduct, and that conclusion is supported by a panel of law enforcement advisors who say these tactics make their policing difficult.
We feel that these community raids are leading to profiling of immigrants. They are pushing immigrants further underground and further away from law enforcement. And at the end of the day, they are expensive.
Ali Noorani is the executive director of the National Immigration Forum in Washington, D.C.
Do we want to live in a country where a law enforcement official is barging down a door? That is not who we are as a country.
Law professor Peter Markowitz traced the increase in home raids back to 2006. The Bush administration was gearing up for immigration reform, and to gain support, they wanted to get tough on undocumented immigrants. So the yearly quota for the ICE arrest teams was raised drastically. It was 125 arrests a year, but that jumped to 1,000. Also, the new rules allowed agents to arrest anyone they found during home raids, not just violent criminals. Immigration officials do not use the term quota. They say, quote, firm numerical goals, and now point out that they did reduce them just this July. Also, agents will now focus on arresting those convicted of serious or violent crimes. Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano spoke with NPR's Scott Simon recently and emphasized the new priorities.
With ICE, which is Immigration and Customs Enforcement, we have really changed the direction there to focus on those kinds of criminals as opposed to just going out and doing what were called raids or sweeps or whatever, so you jack up your numbers. But you're not really getting at those who, I think, present a public safety risk as well as a immigration violation at the same time.
Peter Markowitz says he welcomes the changes in arrest quotas, but says that so far this just nibbles around the edges of the problem. The report calls for new guidelines and retraining of agents and a requirement that they have to get a warrant from a judge to raid any home. For Latino USA, this is Katie Davis in Washington, D.C.
In a minute, el nuevo sonido del flamenco. The worlds of jazz and flamenco collide. Coming up on Latino USA, quédense con nosotros.
Hi, it's me again. This podcast of Latino USA is made possible by contributors to public radio stations. They help pay the freight and cover the costs of making the program available to you to hear when it's convenient. If you're already a member of your public radio station, thanks. If you're not, I hope you'll rethink that decision and make a contribution to support this program and others like it. Visit us at latinousa.org to find a public radio station near you and join the ranks of El Pueblo que Escucha Latino USA. Also, Great opportunities exist for companies and organizations to reach the Latino USA audience online, on air, and through these weekly podcasts. If you're interested in having a tremendous impact on the production of this program, consider underwriting Latino USA. For more information, visit us at latinousa.org/support. And thanks for listening. You're listening to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. For the last 30 years, flamenco musicians in Spain have fused their classical sound with rock, jazz, and other American influences. The results have gotten acclaim from both critics and audiences around the world. Independent producer Reese Ehrlich visited the Montreal Jazz Festival. There he spoke with Spanish and American musicians who are now taking that fusion in a whole new direction.
In 1979, Spanish flamenco guitarist Paco de Lucia joined with two American jazz musicians to form the Guitar Trio. The technically adept and rhythmically challenging fusion of flamenco and jazz became a worldwide hit. Guitarist Al Damiola, a member of the Guitar Trio, says he was entranced by the sound of flamenco. It reminded him of his early musical influences.
I grew up with Latin music, listening to Latin music, and also hanging out in certain clubs in New York City that were more salsa-based. And then later on, you know, the years that I played with Paco was pretty intense, too. You know? So we had a real strong rhythmic simpatico together.
I asked what musical similarities he sees between flamenco and jazz.
It's different than bebop swing, of course, but it's nevertheless it swings. If it has good clave feel, and you know, and the varieties of rhythms that you can employ in this type of music is extreme. A lot of it I did pick up from my influences with flamenco.
Now a stage show called Jazzing Flamenco has taken the fusion efforts by pioneers Paco de Lucia and Al Damiola in a new direction. Based in Madrid, the show consists of dance and music productions that start with classical flamenco and then evolve into complex melodies with influences of jazz, rock, and pop. Show director and choreographer Antonio Nojaro says he's trying to incorporate not only other musical influences, but a visual feel as well.
I want to show something different. I'm always looking for different music and different supports for my choreographies. When I go to see a concert of jazz, I'm not only listening to the music, I'm looking all around. What's the feeling of the concert? What's the feeling of the singer, of the musicians? What I feel?
Nojaro designs his own costumes, which range from the brightly colored, tight-fitting men's flamenco suits to slinky orange unisex pants and shirts. He's trying to portray the glamour of jazz.
Like here in the International Jazz Festival of Montreal, when I see concerts, one of the biggest feelings for me is the night, the glamour, the lights, the costumes. Is something like very high level, quality, glamour. This is my first impression. After there is the music composition, how is the voice of the singer, how is the guitar playing, you know, this is for me the second part.
In this number called Cupa, male dancers line up across the full length of the stage. They thrust forward their arms as if imitating the gang rumble scene from West Side Story. But instead of switchblades, they flick castanets. Jazzing flamenco composer Fernando Agofque says this number includes musical influences from his youth in Argentina.
No hay que hacer ningún esfuerzo para fusionar una música. Entonces,
there's really no special effort that I put into fusing music. It's more from the Latin American air I breathe musically. It can have tango, jazz, maybe rock. Pretty much all that I've listened to since I was a teenager.
En lo que yo he vivido de niño y adolescente.
The dancing also includes many influences, from modern to ballet, and of course, heel-clicking flamenco. Choreographer Najaro says he puts the dancers through a rigorous daily practice routine.
I like to take young people. We have a lot of tours during the year, and it's very hard to do all the days ballet, classic dance. I have older people in my company, like 33, 34 years old, and I use them more for more theatrical pieces, you know, that we pieces that we need more maturity in for expression. But I like to work with young people. The energy is different.
So the old people, the ones who are 33, 34, they've already slowed down, right?
Yeah, little by little.
Jazzing Flamenco's crew of 20-something musicians and dancers is certainly making its mark on the world of flamenco fusion. Meanwhile, guitarist Aldo Miola has continued to fuse flamenco and other Latin elements into his music. He says his current band, World Sinfonia, owes a debt to the great Argentine composer Astor Piazzolla.
The wide range of these emotions, and the music was complex and interesting to play and difficult. At the same time, it's hitting the heart. This is the kind of thing that I want to more explore, and I want this to influence my own composing and my way of playing.
From its very beginnings, jazz fused musical elements from Africa and Europe. That process continues today as musicians from Spain and Latin America add new contributions. For Latino USA, I'm Reese Ehrlich, Montreal.
And for this week, this has been Latino USA. Thanks for listening. Latino USA is produced by Walter Morgan, Mincho Jacob, Angela Maldonado, Alex Avila, and Katie Davis. Our executive producer is Sean Collins. Our listener comment line is 800-445-4005. Our email address is lusa@npr.org. You can visit us online anytime at latinousa.org. Production support for Latino USA comes from KUT Radio, the University of Texas at Austin, the William and Salome Scanlon Foundation of Austin and San Antonio, and the Marguerite Casey Foundation. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week for another edition of NPR's Latino USA.
Support for NPR is provided by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. By Lumber Liquidators, supporter of the National Braille Press and Ronald McDonald House Charities. Hardwood Flooring Catalogs at 1-800-HARDWOOD. And by the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. This is NPR, National Public Radio. To find out how you can reach Latino USA's listeners, visit us online at latinousa.org/support.